Some of the best men in power, seeing the danger of these constant changes, tried even then to prevent the Red and the White Rose Wars. They brought about a great council in London between the two parties. The White Roses assembled in Blackfriars, the Red Roses in Whitefriars, and some good priests communicated between them, and made the proceedings known at evening to the king and the judges. They ended in a peaceful agreement that there should be no more quarrelling, and there was a great royal procession to St. Paul's, in which the queen walked arm in arm with her old enemy, the Duke of York, to show the people how comfortable they all were. This state of peace lasted half a year, when a dispute between the Earl of Warwick, one of the Duke's powerful friends, and some of the King's servants at court, led to an attack upon that Earl who was a White Rosey and to a sudden breaking out of all old animosities. So, here were greater ups and downs than ever. There were even greater ups and downs than these, soon after. After various battles, the Duke of York fled to Ireland, and his son the Earl of March to Calais, with their friends the Earls of Salisbury and Warwick, and a parliament was held declaring them all traitors. Little the worse for this, the Earl of Warwick presently came back, landed in Kent, was joined by the Archbishop of Canterbury and other powerful noblemen and gentlemen, engaged the King's forces at Northampton, signally defeated them, and took the king himself prisoner, who was found in his tent. Warwick would have been glad, I dare say, to have taken the queen and prince too, but they escaped into Wales and thence into Scotland. The king was carried by the victorious force straight to London, and made to call a new parliament, which immediately declared that the Duke of York and those other noblemen were not traitors, but excellent subjects. Then, back comes the Duke from Ireland at the head of 500 horsemen, rides from London to Westminster, and enters the House of Lords. There, he laid his hand upon the cloth of gold which covered the empty throne, as if he had half a mind to sit down in it, but he did not. On the Archbishop of Canterbury, asking him if he would visit the king, who was in his palace close by, he replied, "I know no one in this country, my lord, who ought not to visit me." None of the lords present spoke a single word, so, the Duke went out as he had come in, established himself royally in the King's palace, and, 6 days afterwards, sent into the lords a formal statement of his claim to the throne. The lords went to the king on this momentous subject, and after a great deal of discussion, in which the judges and the other law officers were afraid to give an opinion on either side, the question was compromised. It was agreed that the present king should retain the crown for his life, and that it should then pass to the Duke of York and his heirs. But, the resolute queen, determined on asserting her Celtic right, would hear of no such thing. She came from Scotland to the north of England, where several powerful lords armed in her cause. The Duke of York, for his part, set off with some 5,000 men, a little time before Christmas Day, 1460, to give her battle. He lodged at Sandal Castle, near Wakefield, and the Red Roses defied him to come out on Wakefield Green, and fight them then and there. His generals said, he had best wait until his gallant son, the Earl of March, came up with his power, but, he was determined to accept the challenge. He did so, in an evil hour. He was hotly pressed on all sides, 2,000 of his men lay dead on Wakefield Green, and he himself was taken prisoner. They set him down in mock state on an anthill, and twisted grass about his head, and pretended to pay court to him on their knees, saying, "O king, without a kingdom, and prince without a people, we hope your gracious majesty is very well and happy." They did worse than this. They cut his head off, and handed it on a pole to the queen, who laughed with delight when she saw it. "You recollect their walking so religiously and comfortably to St. Paul's, and had it fixed, with a paper crown upon its head, on the walls of York. The Earl of Salisbury lost his head, too, and the Duke of York's second son, a handsome boy who was flying with his tutor over Wakefield Bridge, was stabbed in the heart by a murderous, Lord Clifford by name, whose father had been killed by the White Roses in the fight at St. Albans. There was awful sacrifice of life in this battle, for no quarter was given, and the queen was wild for revenge. When men unnaturally fight against their own countrymen, they are always observed to be more unnaturally cruel and filled with rage than they are against any other enemy. But, Lord Clifford had stabbed the second son of the Duke of York and not the first. The eldest son, Edward Earl of March, was at Gloucester, and, vowing vengeance for the death of his father, his brother, and their faithful friends, he began to march against the Queen. He had to turn and fight a great body of Welsh and Irish first, who worried his advance. These he defeated in a great fight at Mortimer at Ems Cross, near Hereford, where he beheaded a number of the Red Roses taken in battle, in retaliation for the beheading of the White Roses at Wakefield. The Queen had the next turn of beheading. Having moved towards London, and falling in, between St. Alban at Ems and Barnet, with the Earl of Warwick and the Duke of Norfolk, White Roses both, who were there with an army to oppose her, and had got the King with them, she defeated them with great loss, and struck off the heads of two prisoners of note, who were in the King at Ems tent with him, and to whom the King had promised his protection. Her triumph, however, was very short. She had no treasure, and her army subsisted by plunder. This caused them to be hated and dreaded by the people, and particularly by the London people, who were wealthy. As soon as the Londoners heard that Edward, Earl of March, united with the Earl of Warwick, was advancing towards the city, they refused to send the Queen supplies, and made a great rejoicing. The Queen and her men retreated with all speed, and Edward and Warwick came on, greeted with loud acclamations on every side. The courage, beauty, and virtues of young Edward could not be sufficiently praised by the whole people. He rode into London like a conqueror, and met with an enthusiastic welcome. A few days afterwards, Lord Falconbridge and the Bishop of Exeter assembled the citizens in St. John at Ems Field, Clerkenwell, and asked them if they would have Henry of Lancaster for their king? To this they all roared, "A no, no, no. A.T.M. and A. King Edward. King Edward. A.T.M. then," said those noblemen, "would they love and serve young Edward?" To this they all cried, "A. Yes, yes. A.T.M. and threw up their caps and clapped their hands, and cheered tremendously. Therefore, it was declared that by joining the Queen and not protecting those two prisoners of note, Henry of Lancaster had forfeited the crown, and Edward of York was proclaimed king. He made a great speech to the applauding people at Westminster, and sat down as sovereign of England on the throne, on the golden covering of which his father a worthy of a better fate than the bloody axe which cut the thread of so many lives in England, through so many years had laid his hand." Chapter XXIII. England under Edward IV. King Edward IV was not quite 21 years of age when he took that unquiet seat upon the throne of England. The Lancaster party, the Red Roses, were then assembling in great numbers near York, and it was necessary to give them battle instantly. But, the stout Earl of Warwick leading for the young king, and the young king himself closely following him, and the English people crowding round the royal standard, the White and the Red Roses met, on a wild March day when the snow was falling heavily, at Towton, and there such a furious battle raged between them, that the total loss amounted to 40,000 men, all Englishmen, fighting, upon English ground, against one another. The young king gained the day, took down the heads of his father and brother from the walls of York, and put up the heads of some of the most famous noblemen engaged in the battle on the other side. Then, he went to London and was crowned with great splendor. A new parliament met. No fewer than 150 of the principal noblemen and gentlemen on the Lancaster side were declared traitors, and the king, who had very little humanity, though he was handsome in person and agreeable in manners, resolved to do all he could to pluck up the Red Rose root and branch. Queen Margaret, however, was still active for her young son. She obtained help from Scotland and from Normandy, and took several important English castles. But Warwick soon retook them. The Queen lost all her treasure on board ship in a great storm, and both she and her son suffered great misfortunes. Once, in the winter weather, as they were riding through a forest, they were attacked and plundered by a party of robbers, and, when they had escaped from these men and were passing alone and on foot through a thick dark part of the wood, they came, all at once, upon another robber. So the queen, with a stout heart, took the little prince by the hand, and going straight up to that robber, said to him, "Eh, my friend, this is the young son of your lawful king. I confide him to your care." Atm. The robber was surprised, but took the boy in his arms, and faithfully restored him and his mother to their friends. In the end, the queen atm's soldiers being beaten and dispersed, she went abroad again, and kept quiet for the present. Now, all this time, the deposed King Henry was concealed by a Welsh knight, who kept him close in his castle. But, next year, the Lancaster party, recovering their spirits, raised a large body of men, and called him out of his retirement, to put him at their head. They were joined by some powerful noblemen who had sworn fidelity to the new king, but who were ready, as usual, to break their oaths, whenever they thought there was anything to be got by it. One of the worst things in the history of the War of the Red and White Roses, is the ease with which these noblemen, who should have set an example of honor to the people, left either side as they took slight offense, or were disappointed in their greedy expectations, and joined the other. Well, Warwick atm's brother soon beat the Lancastrians, and the false noblemen, being taken, were beheaded without a momentous atm's loss of time. The deposed king had a narrow escape. Three of his servants were taken, and one of them bore his cap of estate, which was set with pearls and embroidered with two golden crowns. However, the head to which the cap belonged, got safely into Lancashire, and lay pretty quietly there, the people in the secret being very true, for more than a year. At length, an old monk gave such intelligence as led to Henry atm's being taken while he was sitting at dinner in a place called Waddington Hall. He was immediately sent to London, and met at Islington by the Earl of Warwick, by whose directions he was put upon a horse, with his legs tied under it, and paraded three times round the pillory. Then, he was carried off to the Tower, where they treated him well enough. The White Rose being so triumphant, the young king abandoned himself entirely to pleasure, and led a jovial life. But, thorns were springing up under his bed of roses, as he soon found out. For, having been privately married to Elizabeth Woodville, a young widow lady, very beautiful and very captivating, and at last resolving to make his secret known, and to declare her his queen, he gave some offence to the Earl of Warwick, who was usually called the King Maker, because of his power and influence, and because of his having lent such great help to placing Edward on the throne. This offence was not lessened by the jealousy with which the Neville family, the Earl of Warwick atm's, regarded the promotion of the Woodville family. For, the young queen was so bent on providing for her relations, that she made her father in Ireland a great officer of state, married her five sisters to young noblemen of the highest rank, and provided for her younger brother, a young man of 20, by marrying him to an immensely rich old Duchess of 80. The Earl of Warwick took all this pretty graciously for a man of his proud temper, until the question arose to whom the King atm's sister, Margaret, should be married. The Earl of Warwick said, "A to one of the French King atm's sons, atm," and was allowed to go over to the French king to make friendly proposals for that purpose, and to hold all manner of friendly interviews with him. But, while he was so engaged, their Woodville party married the young lady to the Duke of Burgundy. Upon this he came back in great rage and scorn, and shut himself up discontented, in his castle of Middleham. A reconciliation, though not a very sincere one, was patched up between the Earl of Warwick and the King, and lasted until the Earl married his daughter, against the King atm's wishes, to the Duke of Clarence. While the marriage was being celebrated at Calais, the people in the north of England, where the influence of the Neville family was strongest, broke out into rebellion. Their complaint was, that England was oppressed and plundered by the Woodville family, whom they demanded to have removed from power. As they were joined by great numbers of people, and as they openly declared that they were supported by the Earl of Warwick, the king did not know what to do. At last, as he wrote to the Earl beseeching his aid, He and his new son-in-law came over to England, and began to arrange the business by shutting the king up in Middleham Castle in the safekeeping of the Archbishop of York, so England was not only in the strange position of having two kings at once, but they were both prisoners at the same time. Even as yet, however, the kingmaker was so far true to the king, that he dispersed a new rising of the Lancastrians, took their leader prisoner, and brought him to the king, who ordered him to be immediately executed. He presently allowed the king to return to London, and there innumerable pledges of forgiveness and friendship were exchanged between them, and between the Nevilles and the Woodvilles. The king Otm's eldest daughter was promised in marriage to the heir of the Neville family, and more friendly oaths were sworn, and more friendly promises made, than this book would hold. They lasted about 3 months. At the end of that time, the Archbishop of York made a feast for the king, the Earl of Warwick, and the Duke of Clarence, at his house, the Moor, in Hertfordshire. The king was washing his hands before supper, when someone whispered him that a body of 100 men were lying in ambush outside the house. Whether this were true or untrue, the king took fright, mounted his horse, and rode through the dark night to Windsor Castle. Another reconciliation was patched up between him and the kingmaker, but it was a short one, and it was the last. A new rising took place in Lincolnshire, and the king marched to repress it. Having done so, he proclaimed that both the Earl of Warwick and the Duke of Clarence were traitors, who had secretly assisted it, and who had been prepared publicly to join it on the following day. In these dangerous circumstances they both took ship and sailed away to the French court. And here a meeting took place between the Earl of Warwick and his old enemy, the Dowager Queen Margaret, through whom his father had had his head struck off, and to whom he had been a bitter foe. But, now, when he said that he had done with the ungrateful and perfidious Edward of York, and that henceforth he devoted himself to the restoration of the House of Lancaster, either in the person of her husband or of her little son, she embraced him as if he had ever been her dearest friend. She did more than that, she married her son to his second daughter, the Lady Anne. However agreeable this marriage was to the new friends, it was very disagreeable to the Duke of Clarence, who perceived that his father-in-law, the kingmaker, would never make him king, now. So, being but a weak-minded young traitor, possessed of very little worth or sense, he readily listened to an artful court lady sent over for the purpose, and promised to turn traitor once more, and go over to his brother, King Edward, when a fitting opportunity should come. The Earl of Warwick, knowing nothing of this, soon redeemed his promise to the Dowager Queen Margaret, by invading England and landing at Plymouth, where he instantly proclaimed King Henry, and summoned all Englishmen between the ages of 16 and 60, to join his banner. Then, with his army increasing as he marched along, he went northward, and came so near King Edward, who was in that part of the country, that Edward had to ride hard for it to the coast of Norfolk, and thence to get away in such ships as he could find, to Holland. Thereupon, the triumphant kingmaker and his false son-in-law, the Duke of Clarence, went to London, took the old king out of the tower, and walked him in a great procession to St. Paul at Otm's Cathedral with the crown upon his head. This did not improve the temper of the Duke of Clarence, who saw himself farther off from being king than ever, but he kept his secret, and said nothing. The Neville family were restored to all their honours and glories, and the Woodvilles and the rest were disgraced. The kingmaker, less sanguinary than the king, shed no blood except that of the Earl of Worcester, who had been so cruel to the people as to have gained the title of the Butcher. Him they caught hidden in a tree, and him they tried and executed. No other death stained the kingmaker at Otm's triumph. To dispute this triumph, back came King Edward again, next year, landing at Ravenspur, coming on to York, causing all his men to cry, "Ay, long live King Henry!" Atm and swearing on the altar, without a blush, that he came to lay no claim to the crown. Now was the time for the Duke of Clarence, who ordered his men to assume the white rose, and declare for his brother, the Marquis of Montague, though the Earl of Warwick Atm's brother, also declining to fight against King Edward, he went on successfully to London, where the Archbishop of York let him into the city, and where the people made great demonstrations in his favor. For this they had four reasons. Firstly, there were great numbers of the King Otiames adherents hiding in the city and ready to break out. Secondly, the king owed them a great deal of money, which they could never hope to get if he were unsuccessful. Thirdly, there was a young prince to inherit the crown. And fourthly, the king was gay and handsome, and more popular than a better man might have been with the city ladies. After a stay of only 2 days with these worthy supporters, the king marched out to Barnet Common, to give the Earl of Warwick battle. And now it was to be seen, for the last time, whether the king or the kingmaker was to carry the day. While the battle was yet pending, the faint-hearted Duke of Clarence began to repent, and sent over secret messages to his father-in-law, offering his services in mediation with the king. But the Earl of Warwick disdainfully rejected them, and replied that Clarence was false and perjured, and that he would settle the quarrel by the sword. The battle began at 4 o'clock in the morning and lasted until 10, and during the greater part of the time it was fought in a thick mist too absurdly supposed to be raised by a magician. The loss of life was very great, for the hatred was strong on both sides. The kingmaker was defeated, and the king triumphed. Both the Earl of Warwick and his brother were slain, and their bodies lay in St. Paul's, for some days, as a spectacle to the people. Margaret Otiames' spirit was not broken even by this great blow. Within 5 days she was in arms again, and raised her standard in Bath, whence she set off with her army, to try and join Lord Pembroke, who had a force in Wales. But the king, coming up with her outside the town of Tewkesbury, and ordering his brother, the Duke of Gloucester, who was a brave soldier, to attack her men, she sustained an entire defeat, and was taken prisoner, together with her son, now only 18 years of age. The conduct of the king to this poor youth was worthy of his cruel character. He ordered him to be led into his tent. "And what, Atm," said he, "brought you to England?" "Atm, I came to England, Atm," replied the prisoner, with a spirit which a man of spirit might have admired in a captive, "to recover my father Atm's kingdom, which descended to him as his right, and from him descends to me, as mine." Atm, the king, drawing off his iron gauntlet, struck him with it in the face, and the Duke of Clarence and some other lords, who were there, drew their noble swords, and killed him. His mother survived him, a prisoner, for 5 years. After her ransom by the King of France, she survived for 6 years more. Within 3 weeks of this murder, Henry died one of those convenient sudden deaths which were so common in the Tower. In plainer words, he was murdered by the King at Atm's order. Having no particular excitement on his hands after this great defeat of the Lancaster party, and being perhaps desirous to get rid of some of his fat, for he was now getting too corpulent to be handsome, the king thought of making war on France. As he wanted more money for this purpose than the Parliament could give him, though they were usually ready enough for war, he invented a new way of raising it, by sending for the principal citizens of London, and telling them, with a grave face, that he was very much in want of cash, and would take it very kind in them if they would lend him some. It being impossible for them safely to refuse, they complied, and the monies thus forced from them were called, no doubt to the great amusement of the king and the court, who, as if they were free gifts, benevolences. Atm, what with grants from Parliament, and what with benevolences, the king raised an army and passed over to Calais. As nobody wanted war, however, the French king made proposals of peace, which were accepted, and a truce was concluded for 7 long years. The proceedings between the kings of France and England on this occasion were very friendly, very splendid, and very distrustful. They finished with a meeting between the two kings on a temporary bridge over the River Somme, where they embraced through 2 holes in a strong wooden grating like a lion at Atm's cage, and made several bows and fine speeches to one another. It was time, now, that the Duke of Clarence should be punished for his treacheries, and fate had his punishment in store. He was, probably, not trusted by the king, for who could trust him who knew him? And he had certainly a powerful opponent in his brother Richard, Duke of Gloucester, who, being avaricious and ambitious, wanted to marry that widowed daughter of the Earl of Warwick at EMS who had been espoused to the deceased young prince, at Calais. Clarence, who wanted all the family wealth for himself, secreted this lady, whom Richard found disguised as a servant in the city of London, and whom he married. Arbitrators appointed by the king, then divided the property between the brothers. This led to ill will and mistrust between them. Clarence, a TMS wife dying, and he wishing to make another marriage, which was obnoxious to the king, his ruin was hurried by that means, too. At first, the court struck at his retainers and dependents, and accused some of them of magic and witchcraft, and similar nonsense. Successful against this small game, it then mounted to the Duke himself, who was impeached by his brother the King, in person, on a variety of such charges. He was found guilty, and sentenced to be publicly executed. He never was publicly executed, but he met his death somehow, in the Tower, and, no doubt, through some agency of the King or his brother Gloucester, or both. It was supposed at the time that he was told to choose the manner of his death, and that he chose to be drowned in a butt of Malmsey wine. I hope the story may be true, for it would have been a becoming death for such a miserable creature. The king survived him some 5 years. He died in the 42nd year of his life, and the 23rd of his reign. He had a very good capacity and some good points, but he was selfish, careless, sensual, and cruel. He was a favorite with the people for his showy manners, and the people were a good example to him in the constancy of their attachment. He was penitent on his deathbed for his benevolences, ATM and other extortions, and ordered restitution to be made to the people who had suffered from them. He also called about his bed the enriched members of the Woodville family, and the proud lords whose honors were of older date, and endeavored to reconcile them, for the sake of the peaceful succession of his son and the tranquility of England. Chapter 6 of England under Edward V, the late King of TMS' eldest son, the Prince of Wales, called Edward after him, was only 13 years of age at his father at TMS' death. He was at Ludlow Castle with his uncle, the Earl of Rivers. The Prince of TMS' brother, the Duke of York, only 11 years of age, was in London with his mother. The boldest, most crafty, and most dreaded nobleman in England at that time was their uncle Richard, Duke of Gloucester, and everybody wondered how the two poor boys would fare with such an uncle for a friend or a foe. The Queen, their mother, being exceedingly uneasy about this, was anxious that instructions should be sent to Lord Rivers to raise an army to escort the young king safely to London. But, Lord Hastings, who was of the court party opposed to the Woodvilles, and who disliked the thought of giving them that power, argued against the proposal, and obliged the Queen to be satisfied with an escort of 2,000 horse. The Duke of Gloucester did nothing, at first, to justify suspicion. He came from Scotland, where he was commanding an army, to York, and was there the first to swear allegiance to his nephew. He then wrote a condoling letter to the Queen Mother, and set off to be present at the coronation in London. Now, the young king, journeying towards London too, with Lord Rivers and Lord Grey, came to Stony Stratford, as his uncle came to Northampton, about 10 miles distant, and when those two lords heard that the Duke of Gloucester was so near, they proposed to the young king that they should go back and greet him in his name. The boy being very willing that they should do so, they rode off and were received with great friendliness, and asked by the Duke of Gloucester to stay and dine with him. In the evening, while they were merry together, up came the Duke of Buckingham with 300 horsemen, and next morning the two lords and the two dukes, and the 300 horsemen, rode away together to rejoin the king. Just as they were entering Stony Stratford, the Duke of Gloucester, checking his horse, turned suddenly on the two lords, charged them with alienating from him the affections of his sweet nephew, and caused them to be arrested by the 300 horsemen and taken back. Then, he and the Duke of Buckingham went straight to the king, whom they had now in their power, to whom they made a show of kneeling down, and offering great love and submission, and then they ordered his attendants to disperse, and took him, alone with them, to Northampton. A few days afterwards they conducted him to London, and lodged him in the Bishopatiamis palace.